Good afternoon. I think it's afternoon. So I'm really excited to share with you the findings from an open pilot feasibility study. I'll sort of explain to you what the process has been and some of our preliminary findings. But I'm really excited about this project because it's something that we've been working systematically with community to create and build probably over 4 or 5 years. And we're just getting started. Unfortunately or fortunately, I have no relationships to disclose, but that's another session. So the purpose of this study is exactly what I said. So we examined the preliminary effectiveness of cognitive behavioral affirmative coping skills training, which I'm going to call AFFIRM, it's the name of the program, to increase sexual self-efficacy and reduce depression among sexual and gender minority youth in Toronto. And I want to acknowledge one of my lovely co-investigators, Dr. David Brennan, there at the back, also from the Faculty of Social Work, University of Toronto. So what do we know about queer youth? I'll just use that term for now at this point. There's a lot that we know. I think there's certainly lots that we don't know, but in terms of intersecting vulnerabilities for HIV/AIDS and sexual health risks. So, multiple factors such as depression, health risk, sexual behaviors, discrimination, and even perceptions that HIV is not a threat to them may interact to exacerbate their risk for HIV/AIDS. And we also know that within context of depressed queer youth that there are low levels of coping and sexual self-efficacy, which again, if you're familiar with the depression literature, that makes sense. And we certainly know that with regard to mental health disparities, queer youth are overrepresented, particularly with regard to depression. So CBT, particularly CBT that's culturally adapted, have been found to reduce risky sexual behavior and poor mental health leading to HIV infection in a number of populations, including men who have sex with men, racial minority adolescent women, for example, but it hasn't been used in any way for sexual and gender minority youth, at least in most settings and certainly in the literature. So CBT for HIV prevention includes the development of social and negotiation skills to reduce sexual risk-taking behavior and the facilitation of general skills such as decision-making and assertive communication. So we have a lack of evidence-based interventions, or evidence-informed, which is the language that we're using now, that are initiated by and engaged with community, so now coming from the scholarship tower, grounded in the realities of contemporary service delivery, which is one of the challenges, I think, for programs that are created in academic settings. They're not relevant, and there's very little uptake in community settings because they just don't really work with the conditions that are in communities. Systematically developed through practice-based research to enhance the practice toolbox. So this, a CBT program for queer youth is something that should be part of the practitioner's toolbox that they can determine whether or not it makes sense to use in their own setting. And it should be holistic, so focused on the intersection between psychosocial factors, mental health, and sexual risk. And we're seeing more and more of this as the trend, particularly around implementation science and prevention science for youth interventions, that interventions need to be nimble, they need to have a lot of options, and that's really in some ways challenging the common beliefs, I think, in terms of intervention development generally, right? Sort of our RCT track. So I think it's really interesting. So in terms of this particular program, AFFIRM, there's a number of different approaches, of course, that you can use. We use the adapt and evaluate framework, which we've written about, but it really enhances the cultural congruence of interventions that target minority subgroups. And so this is really the third step in that framework. So started with focus groups with youth, went and created, adapted intervention manual with the infusion of a lot of queer affirmative content, and then the open pilot feasibility before you go through the process of scaling up. And we were very committed to and continue to be committed to it's a lot of work, but it's a lot more fun this way, engagement with community. So in terms of our methods, And you can see this is one of the rooms that one of the group sessions was happening in. That was very cute. So we used, like I said, an open pilot study, which is often used in intervention development. And we wanted to see, you know, we had done some initial work, but we wanted to see whether or not this would be feasible and acceptable to queer youth. We thought it might be based on the youth, the earlier youth that we had worked with, but we wanted to make sense, because otherwise, why create something that we won't see positive outcomes from or might not be useful for youth themselves? So we used purposive and venue sampling. Very interesting process, but I won't get into that. I hired two youth staff. Age 16 and 18, they were hired as part of the research team, and they did both online and offline recruitment, really covered sort of the Toronto area and really made us relevant, to be honest with you. Fantastic. And they've both now gone to university, I'm happy to say. I was able to write letters of support for them. So then we did extensive facilitator training, and what we found, for those of you that have worked within the service delivery sector, particularly for LGBTQ youth, is you have a lot of folks who have experience working specifically with queer youth in community-based settings. There's not enough programs, but there are more programs than 15 years ago when I started to do it in community. But we didn't have a lot of folks who were trained in any particular modality, so they didn't have training in CBT. So we had lots of folks that had experience with queer youth, which was one of the prerequisites, but we also needed to make sure that they had experience with CBT. So we had a fairly interesting process in terms of hiring folks, and I did a very extensive facilitator training, and we had six facilitators. The groups are co-facilitated with very diverse identities, which we were happy to do. So we did a pilot implementation, and this is often done now in feasibility studies, literally because it's more feasible. But we did a pilot implementation of this 16-hour group intervention in a workshop format at the community center in downtown Toronto. They were very supportive. So because it was an open pilot feasibility study, we collected a lot of data. Some of our major measures were here. We wanted to make sure that we were using measures that were reliable in the literature. So the sexual self-efficacy questionnaire, the Beck's Depression Inventory, for example, the proactive coping inventory, a number of other measures. And what we did is we had the members of the youth team, a very large community advisory board about 12 folks that helped vet the measures for us. And we ultimately came up with a number of sets of measures. We did three time points, pre-test, post-test, and T3, which is 3 months after the intervention. That was the longest that we could go just with the funding that we had. And we used repeated measures, linear mixed modeling. And so in terms of who attended, the age range was identified to be 14 through 18 that we had ethical approval. We didn't have any 14-year-olds, but we had someone who just had turned 15 the day of his initial assessment. So we had 30 youth, and 82% of the youth were born in Canada. 71%, though, reported at least one newcomer or immigrant parent. So again, we're getting to some of the layers of intersectionality there. Most were accessing other queer youth services, so that's important when we talk about some of the findings. And most had some fear of getting HIV/AIDS and had low initial scores on the sexual self-efficacy measure. And many of them had low scores, too, in some of the HIV knowledge measures as well, which is interesting. That wasn't increasing HIV knowledge was not a focus of this particular intervention. It was specifically targeted at the sexual self-efficacy. So just to be clear, but that was sort of interesting. So in terms of gender identity, we had folks, these were all of the identity categories are non-mutually exclusive. So if you're very good at math, you will note this, all of the percentages are well over 100. But quite a few youth identified as female and trans, non-binary, and queer as well. Not surprising. We had representation, about 64% were at least partially identified as Caucasian, and then a number of other races and ethnicities were identified there. And this, again, if you do queer youth work, you're not surprised at this, but our highest, most of the kids identified in some way as pansexual, many of them, so that's sort of the highest category now, as well as lesbian, lots of kids identifying as bisexual, queer, questioning, number of others as well. I learned a lot, as you always do with community-based research. In terms of risk factors, these were just yes, no, self-identified risk factors, just to, again, create a profile. And so many of the youth had expressed concerns around anxiety, problems sleeping, which is interesting, depression, which of course then we found in the data, 31% had attempted suicide. So again, if you're used to doing work with this population, this is not uncommon. But again, this is sort of the profile of risk in which we're trying to do some of this HIV and mental health work. And of course, in terms of what they'd experienced, high rates of abuse and 44.8%, again, these are the numbers that we see in most of the urban cores, but had been homeless at least at one point. They were not homeless now. There were only three or four that were homeless then, so we brought them into additional services. So what did we find in terms of our outcomes? So we saw a significant reduction in depression on the Beck's Depression Inventory, and we saw an increase in sexual self-efficacy and reflective coping, which again, if you're familiar with CBT, those really both map onto the underlying format that we're thinking about, that's critical to CBT, is we want folks to be reflective and understand the relationship between their thoughts and their behavior in particular, as well as their feelings. What I did want to note, though, when we're talking about the Beck's Depression Inventory score, is it's great. We're very happy that it went down statistically significantly. If you're not familiar with the Beck's, and this is working, I'm working with the Beck's in most of my intervention studies now. So the youth went from moderate depression down to borderline clinical depression. So it went down significantly, so we're happy about that, but it's still really high, particularly for youth, that most of them who are getting services at other agencies, right? So I think it's just really important. It's very important to provide safe spaces, but it's also for youth that might, and probably more than we think, that are experiencing high rates of depression, it's also important to have something else in the toolbox that can address this very systematically, for example, like a firm or a CBT-adapted intervention. So in terms of preliminary acceptability, we had a number of different acceptability measures that we created specifically for this study. But just some of the language that you see here, they learned a lot. They're going to apply it. They can use it to help with their problems. The third bullet point, a firm has helped me think about how my feelings, actions, and thoughts are connected. So mostly for all of these, we agree and strongly agree. The feedback was quite good. And they will apply what they learned in their life. And some of the things that were considered most helpful were learning tools to deal with stress, restoring my faith in humanity, which is a lot for 2 days, I don't know. What was also really interesting is the manual. So we'd created, and over time we'd adapted a manual, and the youth were able to, if they wanted it, have the manual. So it's the same manual that the facilitators have, right? So there aren't any surprises for them. And so we provided them with the manual, and for those youth that wanted it, and most of them wanted it, and they really liked it, which was really interesting. They liked the fact that they knew what to anticipate, and they knew that they could trust the facilitators because the facilitators were essentially keeping to that manual. So I thought that was interesting. Lots of coping, lots of feedback around sort of the positive, affirmative environment, and it should be, since that's the name of the program. So we learned a great deal, and we're currently writing up a number of different papers around doing HIV prevention interventions specifically with communities in terms of development of interventions, because again, that's I think something that's very interesting. So we think that the findings are promising. Again, this wasn't an RCT or even a quasi-experimental study. We just had multiple time points, but particularly for youth in community, what we find, so again, in HIV interventions, often the interventions are perhaps out of necessity, but targeted for a very particular subpopulation. So maybe a particular subgroup of MSM of a certain age that are part of a particular racial or ethnic community. So that's great. What we're finding, though, in community-based organizations, and sexual health-based organizations is we need to be able to provide empirically-based services to everybody who walks through the door. And for queer youth, they're showing up to these services. They're not just showing up with people that are part of the sub population that they're with. They're showing up with their, you know, maybe a young trans man is coming in with a lesbian who's coming in with somebody who identifies as bi. And so we want to make sure that we have an intervention that works for everybody who walks through the door. And that's one of the, again, it flies in the face in some ways of conventional intervention development techniques, but we think that's really important. And that's what we heard from community, which is sort of where all this came from. So in terms of what we're trying to do is do some scaling up to get into some additional remote areas or more rural areas, let's say, that are outside of the urban core, and trying to also incorporate technology, particularly for some of the follow-ups, and to have the resources available. For example, the manual could be available electronically for youth that might not feel safe taking it home because they're concerned about what their parents might say. Right? So all of these different things that we're trying to build into hopefully future innovations. And we had a very big community-based team and from a number of different organizations that were part of this really fun community advisory board, and I'm really grateful to them for their wisdom and their expertise and, you know, their guidance and saying what's really relevant. I'm particularly grateful to the youth staff that worked on this project, because again, they really enlightened us, and to the Affirm youth participants. I've just been told that fierce is not a cool word anymore, that people don't use it, but I would just like to still use it for the last time. So, and this was funded by a very small CIHR, which is Canadian Institute of Health Research grant, and a small grant from our Faculty of Social Work. So hopefully I'm fine. Thank you.
Thank you.